Welcome to Pop and Lock. I'm Landry Ayers.
And I'm Aaron Powell.
Ripped from the headlines, John Le Carré's Tinker, Tailor, Soldier, Spy is a tightly woven plot of intrigue, espionage, and entrapment. But George Smiley, one of the circus's top intelligence officials, is on the case of this knotted mess, pulling the threads and following them all the way to the top. Here to break down the legacy of one of the UK's most enduring characters are Cato Institute Senior Fellow, Pat Eddington.
Greetings.
As well as Mike German, Fellow with the Brennan Center for Justice's Liberty and National Security Program and author of Disrupt, Discredit, and Divide, How the New FBI Damages Democracy. Welcome to the show, Mike.
Thank you for having me. I appreciate it.
So George Smiley and the stories that he appears in don't look an awful lot like James Bond or other espionage stories many of us have seen. So I thought maybe we'd start off with, how realistic is this? How much does this portray the way that intelligence and counterintelligence actually functions in practice?
I would say that on balance, because Le Carré himself, and that's his pen name for those who may be wondering, he was himself an officer in British MI6, their external intelligence service, if you will. So, you know, from the standpoint of human intelligence and playing offense and defense, I think you'd be hard-pressed to find somebody, you know, better qualified in that respect. And in terms of a lot of the basic tradecraft things, you know, the smuggling documents out. I had some experience doing that when I was doing my whistleblowing thing. All that kind of stuff. The clandestine meeting type stuff, all of those kinds of things. That's, I think, at this point, you know, fairly common knowledge from a tradecraft standpoint. Was not so much back in 1973 when this book was written, but I think pretty much is today.
And I would agree with that. I think that, you know, people have the idea, of course, perpetuated by the James Bond idea that spying and undercover work is this very glamorous type of activity. But in fact, in order to be good at that, you have to be able to blend in and not appear threatening to anyone. And, you know, I found doing undercover criminal work that the more violent the group was, the more non-threatening you had to be. Because, of course, you don't want to provoke somebody's interest in proving they're tougher than you, because that's uncomfortable as an undercover agent. You have enough problems to deal with trying to keep everything together and gather the evidence you want. You don't need to be drawing unwarranted attention.
I'm curious, specifically, I was thinking about the 1979 BBC miniseries, which is what I watched to prepare for this episode, even though there's the wonderful Gary Oldman film and a lot of other adaptations. There's a really great BBC radio play version that I also recommend that I listened to several years ago. But specifically, the BBC miniseries, a big theme that they hit upon is the idea of service and the sort of motivations of these characters and who they are intending to serve, whether it's, you know, the mole that we find out at the end and sort of his line that I think he says is, I still believe the secret services are the only true expressions of a nation's character. And this is interesting because specifically Le Carré in 2010 was doing an interview where he was sort of criticizing the invasion of Iraq and things like that. And he likens the intelligence officers that he worked with, that he sort of amalgamated and based George Smiley off of, almost like good journalists, he says. It's about speaking truth to power. And this sort of very clear-headed, unbiased service to the nation. Is that the kind of attitude that is still being cultivated in today's intelligence? Or is there, like we sort of see in a lot of different, you know, administrative positions, a sort of politicization of that? And is there any sort of bleed through of that into those sectors?
So I would have to say that certainly in a CIA context, but also kind of the broader U.S. intelligence community context. And then I'll talk about the British side of this in a second. that I think that idea of objectivity has always been a little bit of a myth, not entirely, but a little bit of a myth. And you go back to guys like Sherman Kent, you know, way back in the day, you know, immediately post-World War II and early Cold War. There was an effort to try to cultivate that kind of an ethic, much more so in what we call the Directorate of Intelligence at the CIA. This is literally like the think tank component of the CIA. When you're talking about actual Directorate of Operations officers, I mean, here now I'm talking about the actual human spies or the people that basically try to run agent networks, if you will, overseas. You know, when you teach people how to lie and how lying is so central to the success of the job, I think it's naive to believe that they're just going to be able to flick that off like a light switch when it comes to how they deal with people in their own country. In our case, you know, people in Congress and so on and so forth. So I think there's always been a tension there, and always, in my judgment at least, a fundamental ethical dilemma. You know, it's one thing to basically take imagery intelligence, signals intelligence, and whatever human intelligence you can gather and sit down and analyze that the same way that, you know, our scholars at Cato, you know, analyze what's available publicly, right? That's one thing. It's another thing entirely to try to, you know, essentially penetrate somebody else's networks physically, right? And recruit people and run them on the basis essentially of both self-deception and the deception of the hostile actors that you're working against. So there's always, in my judgment at least, there's always been a tension there.
And, you know, especially doing criminal work as an investigator for the FBI, you plumb motive because it's an essential element of most crimes, and particularly working undercover, trying to figure out how to get close to people. And I think it's a mistake to assume that human beings operate with just one motive. And, you know, certainly that concept of service and the idea of patriotism, I'm sure most people who go into government work of any kind have that motive as part of their interest in pursuing that line of work. But, you know, I also was, you know, very much an adrenaline junkie and went to the FBI because I couldn't see sitting behind a desk and doing lawyer work as something that would interest me. So I think there are a multiplicity of motives at any one time. And I think part of the problem that we see, and I think part of why Le Carré, I think, is appreciated in the intelligence and law enforcement community is because it does show that ambiguity. And, you know, these are very much monocultures to a large degree. And they have this very rigorous application and security screening process that keeps them as monocultures. And because they have a peek behind the curtain, and they can see secrets that the rest of the public doesn't have access to, it's very easy to start believing that you know better than the democratic public about what is right and what is wrong and what is necessary and what should be done for the good of all. And that is often the path that leads to really dangerous and reckless and unhelpful types of activities.
And in the movie, the 2011 movie with Gary Oldman, you have that sequence that really kind of underscores, you know, what Mike just talked about, where you have Percy Alleline, who's, you know, now essentially maneuvered himself into being the new control. And that bureaucratic gamesmanship, that's spot on. That's totally spot on. That's one of the most authentic things about the entire book, just period. But you have Alleline, and then I think it was Roy Bland who was sitting there talking to Lacan of the Treasury. About this extremely expensive safe house they were using for this witchcraft project and so on and so forth. And as Lacan basically tries to, you know, question the expense, Bland just, you know, blows up about essentially, you know, we're all that's standing between you and World War III and so on and so forth, right? So that very self-righteous attitude of, you know, we know best that Mike just talked about, that's very much spot on. And it's well conveyed, especially in the movie.
I wanted to pick up on something Mike said about, you mentioned ambiguity. And so Dr. No, the first James Bond film, came out a couple of years before Le Carré's first major novel, The Spy Who Came In From a Cold, hit. And the difference between those two portrayals of espionage is rather stark. And one of the interesting things about The Spy Who Came From the Cold, which is a absolutely phenomenal novel, is the ambiguity of it, is that this is, it's kind of tired men playing a game that seems almost without purpose. And I wonder about that, and also in light of Tinker Tailor, how much, like in Le Carré's fiction, it feels like these are characters who are, they're engaged in intelligence gamesmanship against each other, but the actual intelligence itself, the, you know, like we've got information about troop movements or about plans, seems periphery to the game at best. Like this is just about one-upping each other. And so I wondered how much of that is true of like what it's like inside of intelligence gathering, whether that's in the criminal arena or in, you know, the more espionage arena, where it's about the people engaged in it are about the game itself and versus like the actual value of what it is that they're pursuing.
I think that's, and I know that at least at one point, Le Carré said that his writing about George Smiley was an antidote to the James Bond version of what the spycraft is. I think you're right. I think that, you know, they say that when Truman first wanted to have a post-war intelligence agency, really what he wanted was a global news clipping service, you know, that he wanted that information, and kind of what Le Carré said about, you know, being just sort of high-powered, effective journalists providing information, where very quickly after the CIA was created, it took on this covert action role that is somewhat conflicting with the intelligence gathering mission. And I do think that there is a lot of spy versus spy gamesmanship going on that really has nothing to do with whether we're getting the accurate information. And in fact, you know, the intelligence community becomes a warning system rather than providing information that policymakers can make better decisions. And it's just constantly warning, 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 warning. And policymakers can't really do anything with that, right? If I have 10 warnings of possible harm to come, how do I know what needs immediate attention? And I think that's what the statement that George Bush made after he was given the Al-Qaeda briefing before 9/11, where, you know, his response reportedly was, okay, now you've covered your ass, right? That this becomes just, well, we want to be able to go back and say we warned about every possible thing so that we can say we did our job. And it's no longer about actually providing an accurate picture for policymakers to make wise decisions. Rather, it's put in a way that empowers the agencies, that becomes the primary mission, empower and protect the agency from any criticism.
So one of my favorite phrases is the bureaucratic self-licking ice cream cone, right? So this is, and to kind of get directly at what you were asking about previously, Aaron, this idea of competition among these three-letter agencies in the United States, and I'm sure it was the same way to some degree between MI5 and MI6, is a very real thing. And what's, you know, what's really kind of been fascinating to me in the course of doing all this research for this book that I've been working on is looking at how much effort Army intelligence and Navy intelligence and the FBI expended trying to prevent the CIA from being created in the first place. They really spent a lot of time, you know, trying to talk Truman out of that, and they failed in the end. And the thing about the agency, of course, is that its origins under Wild Bill Donovan was absolutely as a covert action organization. I mean, that's what the Office of Strategic Services was all about. Yes, they were supposed to be collecting intel, but their big thing and the thing they preferred to do and the thing that Donovan preferred to do was to operate behind enemy lines, whether it was the German lines or Japanese lines or whatever, and blow stuff up. I mean, it's just really that simple, you know, going after things of that nature. And if you collected intel along the way, that's great. But it was that action-oriented part of it that really animated Donovan. And it was that aspect of it, the agency's ability to engage in those kinds of covert actions that became, I would essentially say, an addictive policy drug for successive presidents. It was definitely the case under Eisenhower. John Kennedy wound up with a real pile of stuff as a result of what Eisenhower handed him with these Bay of Pigs plans that they went ahead with anyway, when it was clear it was going to be a disaster. On through, let's say, you know, things like the Phoenix program in Vietnam and so on and so forth. So it's inevitably been the covert action arm of the CIA that has gotten the agency into trouble over and over and over again. And that's what Truman was lamenting, you know, toward the end of his life, especially. That's just not what I had in mind, essentially, is what he was telling people. And that continues to, you know, be a problem that we have today. You know, you've got the agency out there, along with the military, but the agency very heavily operating a drone program, a lethal drone program. And to quote former CIA director and former NSA director Michael Hayden, quote, "We kill people using metadata," end quote. Well, you wind up killing an awful lot of innocent people, you know, when you do that. And it just kind of underscores, I think, the mindset that we've been talking about, that, you know, they get to play God and they get an awful lot of money to do it. And the result, as we have seen, especially in the so-called War on Terror era, has been just a disaster for the United States, reputationally, especially.
So you mentioned like the covert operations. And so Le Carré has another novel in the George Smiley series, The Looking Glass War, which is basically about people who have no idea what they're doing in covert operations, trying to pull one off, and it ends poorly. It's another terrific, I keep saying terrific novels. I think Le Carré might be my favorite author. So I'll just like state right now, all of his novels are terrific, but it makes me wonder, like, so we, you know, espionage fiction, and fiction about undercover and intelligence gathering is very popular because it feels like very cool, right? Like it's exciting and it's, and like the, you know, the playing it out is cool. And I wonder, like, how much does that sense of this stuff is just cool factor into the way that the people who are actually doing it approach it? Because I'm thinking of, you mentioned like all of the undercover or the operational stuff, but like Alan Dulles constantly as director of CIA was just like, well, what we should do is we should drop expatriates in behind enemy lines in order to disrupt things. And almost without fail, they would get dropped in, parachuted in, and then they would just disappear because they either ran off with the money or they got captured and killed or whatever. But it felt like kind of like reading that history of the CIA, especially in the 50s and 60s, feels like a bunch of boys who have a bunch of fun stuff to do and are trying to do fun stuff. And then on the FBI side, like Hoover had a slightly different approach, but a lot of it ends up feeling like just kind of, we've got cool tools to use and we're making it up as we go along.
I think in the beginning, you know, at CIA, that emphasis on covert action, certainly in the 50s and 60s, it overshadowed almost anything analytical. Not entirely, but almost so. And it became, you know, a real problem. I can only speak for myself in terms of how I felt, you know, when I got the job in 1988, which was literally at the tail end of the Cold War. But the idea for me to be able to sit there as a 25-year-old and control a multi-hundred-million-dollar satellite and point it at places on the Earth outside the United States in order to take lots of pictures and then sit down and figure out what was going on, yeah, that was just pretty damn cool. There's no question about it. It was a tremendous amount of fun. My first 3 years there were just amazing. They were just, you know, life-changing in that respect. But, you know, once you're inside an organization long enough and you begin to kind of understand the culture, the monoculture that Mike so eloquently spoke of, that's when you begin to see the warts. That's when you begin to really kind of understand, you know, what the priorities are and what they should be and are not. And I think, you know, when we had a single monolithic or relatively monolithic target like the Soviet Union, it did in some ways make things easier. It made it easier to focus. I always knew essentially what I was supposed to be doing. I had a whole series of Soviet installations and military units that I was responsible for monitoring. And, you know, we had a very, very detailed system of collection for doing that kind of thing. And that's the world of technical intelligence, though. And I think that's, I'm reluctant to use the word it's a cleaner form of intelligence gathering, but I think in many respects it is. That's not to say that it isn't subject to potential deception and denial type operations. It's harder to do that with imagery than it is with signals intelligence, but it can be done. Whereas I've always felt that in the human intelligence world, you are dealing with a hall of mirrors. And that's why I admire that Mike spent so much time, you know, in the trenches trying to do this in the criminal world in an undercover kind of capacity, because you're doing nothing but dealing with different individuals with different motives, different agendas, maybe some of them overlap, but trying to figure out essentially who's lying to you, to the extent to which they're lying to you, all the rest of that. That's, in my judgment, an infinitely harder business to be in than to sit around and look at satellite imagery or even drone footage or, you know, anything like that. So it's, if you're in technical intelligence, I always think people feel like that was really cool, and, you know, and it was, but it's the human side of it, I think, is just so much harder to work. And I think Licari does a great job of bringing that out. You know, this whole issue of Ricky Tarr, you know, is this guy, has he been turned, you know, all this stuff. It's Hall of Mirrors is, I think, the best way for me to kind of describe how I feel about it.
And I think that's true. And I should say that I have a tremendous respect for people who do undercover work in the espionage field, are going into foreign countries, because while, you know, certainly the risks were as high or perhaps even higher when you're dealing with a criminal organization that would, you know, immediately take some violent action against you if they found out who you were, where perhaps a foreign nation might just, you know, embarrass your nation and send you home, never to return. But, you know, obviously there is risk there, and the tools that the state has are so much stronger than what the criminals have, as far as trying to use their police powers to uncover the identity, and also the length of time. I mean, for most of my undercover cases, if I spent 2 hours with the criminal element, that was preceded by 2 hours of preparation with the case agent and the other agents working on the task force and the surveillance team, and then 2 hours of debriefing afterwards. So it wasn't that constant pressure of maintaining cover. But I think part of what makes it interesting is that you are dealing with this mix of motives where, you know, say we would have I have a big meeting going on where I'm going to be engaged in some kind of criminal activity in a dangerous context. So we have surveillance up and we're watching this person that I'm meeting with all day long, and we can see him go to Home Depot and, you know, go and have lunch with a friend and do a couple of other things before our meeting. And I get there and say, hey, you know, what have you been up to today? Haven't left the house, which I know is a lie, but now I have to figure out, okay, why is he lying? You know, did he pick up surveillance and he's testing me? You know, what is going on? So you, even in that much smaller context, you do have that hall of mirrors that, what is it that I'm dealing with here? And how do I make sense of the fragmentary pieces of knowledge that I have when I have to recognize that my bias is that he's doing something dangerous to me, because if I don't keep that bias, my guard will go down, and that's not good. So, you know, you're not paranoid if somebody really is out to get you.
You know, the one nit that I have with the book and with the movie, the 2011 movie, and this is like, you have to be an intelligence guy to kind of appreciate this to a certain degree, I think. But if you remember the scene when they're when witchcraft is essentially revealed in terms of that naval exercise document that they got. And they were basically, you know, Smiley was like, you know, could be gold dust, but, you know, and so on and so forth. And of course, the mole himself, Hayden, is in the room when all this is going on. And all I could think was, well, what did GCHQ have to say about the exercise? What did the signals intelligence guys have to say about what happened during that exercise? What kind of radar emissions were picked up? And what was the comms traffic like and all the rest of that? And for me, that was the missing piece in terms of confirming or denying, really, whether or not there was any kind of value there. So that's like a genuine, like, professional nit that I have with how the book unfolded. That just kind of gets to the total focus essentially on the human aspect of this and the human intelligence aspect of it. But you have lots of ways that you can uncover human spies. And the most famous case that we know of that's public, of course, is the Rosenbergs. And that was, of course, accomplished after the fact through the decryption of the Soviet, or partial decryption of the Soviet Venona code.
So this leads into something that I found curious in. So as I was researching for this episode, I came across the CIA has an in-house journal called Studies in Intelligence. And I think it was in 2018, they published a review of the Gary Oldman film of Tinker, Tailor, Soldier, Spy, which is very interesting, and we'll put a link to it in the show notes. It's worth reading. But they point out one of the changes that movie makes to the original material, which is there's a scene in the Gary Oldman one where Smiley tells Peter Gwillem, who's like his right-hand man, his Watson, that it's possible that what they're doing is going to be found out because they're investigating this mole, you know, on the down low. And to clear up any loose ends that might be out there, and in a change from the novel. So in the novel, Peter Gwillem is straight, and in later novels has a family, has a wife and kids. But in this movie, he is in a homosexual relationship. And so there's a scene where he goes and basically kicks out his boyfriend, you know, because if this is exposed, it's a hook. And I wondered about that in light of what you guys were talking about kind of the focusing in on minorities and whatnot, like how that, so I should note that the CIA journal takes offense at this change, and they say, quote, "There's no context, no follow-up, and no apparent significance to this revelation. It's difficult not to interpret this change as gestures to political correctness," which to me seemed to entirely miss the point of this scene. But the way that minorities get treated within intelligence and law enforcement communities, because I know, like the FBI for a long time, if you were found out to be gay, you were fired. In the CIA, it was a similar thing because it was seen as something where, you know, that could be leverage used against you to flip you, to turn you, to get information out of you, blackmail you, and so on. Like, how does that sort of stuff play out in these kinds of scenarios, both in terms of like from the counterintelligence, but also in terms of getting people to turn on their employers to become double agents because you have this leverage over them?
So that entire issue of homosexuality being something that would get you kicked off the federal payroll is directly tied to Executive Order 10450, which was Eisenhower's update to Truman's infamous government employee loyalty program executive order. And the formal adding essentially of that language about sexual activity and so on and so forth, that became essentially an excuse to go through and conduct anti-gay witch hunts throughout the entire federal government. And that's something that continued, you know, literally for decades. And because it was was viewed as disqualifying from an employment standpoint, it then, of course, becomes a place whereby, you know, you have a vulnerability, a counterintelligence vulnerability. And in the case of Britain, homosexuality was actually illegal. It was actually literally against the law for a good period of time. And that's, you know, and I understood that instantly when I saw that scene. that, you know, Smiley was trying to make sure that Gwilym did not literally go to jail, not simply for going, you know, into MI5 to try to liberate, or MI6 to try to liberate information to expose them all, but because of his sexual orientation was discovered, he would definitely go to jail. So this is something that was absolutely a thing, at least up through the Clinton administration, until you began to kind of see, you know, a change. And of course, on the national security side, kind of the DOD side, this is when we begin to see this don't ask, don't tell bastardization policy, as I like to call it, rather than, you know, just confronting it, you know, directly. But this is when things, you know, begin to change. Now, I don't know whether or not this is necessarily still something of, you know, overall counterintelligence concern at CIA. I tend to doubt it's not as much of one as it once was. I can't speak to the Bureau. Mike would be better positioned to say that. But if somebody, I could see if somebody was in a closeted gay relationship, but actually had a heterosexual family, that would create a blackmail situation that could be a counterintelligence issue. But I think an openly gay relationship, you know, now I would tend to doubt that would be as big a deal from a counterintelligence standpoint. I think they're much more concerned, always going to be much more concerned about any kind of close and continuing contact with foreign nationals.
And, you know, I found the CIA criticism kind of laughable. I mean, on the one hand, that's absolutely correct. This was an error towards political correctness in that it was politically accurate, right? That it was in a very, you know, you're a filmmaker and you're trying to turn this wonderful book that has all these twists and turns into an hour and a half. You know, how do you convey something that the audience will immediately understand what you're getting at and show that bias within the intelligence community? And I agree completely with Pat that by the late 90s, that had pretty much gone. But there was a period where, you know, as Pat used that term, the self-licking ice cream cone, where, you know, what the security establishment would say is, well, we don't care if you're in a homosexual relationship. We're just afraid that it might be used against you. So that's why it becomes an issue for us, because it's like, okay, you just, you know, if you made it that it didn't matter, then it couldn't be used against them. You know, it's like you have to decide one or the other. Either it's an issue from a counterintelligence perspective or it's not. But you can't sort of exonerate yourself by saying, well, you know, the bad guys might target you because of this, so we have to treat you like a pariah. No, that's not really what's happening here, you know, and, you know, to the extent any illicit relationship, heterosexual or homosexual, could be fodder for somebody to blackmail you. You know, that certainly the sex of the person shouldn't matter. And I don't think does anymore. I think people are past that at the FBI.
I'm curious, because this is sort of coming up between what Pat was talking about and some things that you were mentioning, Mike, specifically talking about the experience of being undercover, but also the, you know, being behind enemy lines. And we've talked a lot about what the intelligence officers, you know, the people who are quote unquote on our side, are sort of doing day to day and what their experience is like and their motivations. But it's really curious, because this story specifically was influenced not just, you know, on Le Carré's experience in, you know, doing that, but also it was born specifically out of the, you know, incident with Kim Philby and the Cambridge Five, something that really happened where Kim Philby, a double agent for the Soviet Union who had been acting as an intelligence officer for the UK, flipped and, you know, obviously blew a bunch of people's cover, including John Le Carré, who at the time, you know, had to leave
position. That's the silver lining, is if Kim Philby hadn't done what he did, we wouldn't have all these novels. So.
Yeah, he really did us a favor there. But Bill Hayden, for instance, he was undercover for decades, for a long period of time. I don't know how much of that, you know, he was, you know, getting breaks and, you know, having 2 hours to meet with somebody else and 2 hours, you know, 2 hours on, 2 hours off. You know, does he get a 15-minute smoke break? I don't know. But what is that experience like? What is it like to be the one lying for that extended period of time? And who is the kind of person that becomes specifically a double agent? Like, that takes, I think, an extra level of ability to sort of regulate the and manage the persona that you are, you know, trying to present to someone, because not only specifically in intelligence, you're trying to be the person on the inside for one, but you're managing secrets for both sides. What is that like?
Well, I think that, you know, one of the things that Tinker Tailor Soldier Spy does is really kind of convey that tension, essentially, and the level of skill. And the thing is, you know, Colin Firth plays the character that we're talking about here, Bill Hayden, the double agent, who I think in many, many respects really was kind of based on Kim Philby. You know, Philby went to work for the NKVD, the Soviet intelligence service back then, I think at least as early as 1940. So he was basically on their payroll for almost a quarter of a century. And, you know, he was suspected on the basis of Guy Burgess and Donald McLean, two other members of the so-called Cambridge Five, defecting in 1951, if I remember correctly. And Philby was subjected to this, you know, examination, even separated from the service, but he was cleared in 1955. And then he goes back to work undercover for MI6, basically posing as a journalist, right? So I think someone who is successful in beating the system, if you will, and being a mole, being a really good actor undoubtedly helps. The ability to kind of have two personalities really helps. But the other thing that plays into this, and I'm thinking specifically here about the Aldrich James episode at the CIA, is just the lousy counterintelligence tradecraft, you know, the sloppiness of it, the failure to kind of look at it. And I would also say in Ames' case, the insane reliance on the polygraph, right? I mean, we know on the basis of science now, I mean, it is 20 years ago, that the National Academies, you know, actually looked at this entire question. And, you know, it's like an electronic Ouija board. Right. I mean, it's a good polygrapher can get you to confess to things that you never did. But that's much more of a human element. Right. I mean, sure, the technology is kind of hovering there in the background the whole time. But a cop that's really good, you know, at interrogation can get people to confess. They can break them down, you know, and they can do it in, you know, in various ways. I mean, a lot of times you see like this good cop, bad cop kind of thing. My favorite cop show of the 1990s, hands down, was NYPD Blue. And of course, Andy Sipowicz is my favorite character. And I'm ashamed to say that I cheered every time he beat the crap out of a suspect, because most times they really did seem to deserve it. But that isn't how good interrogation takes place, as Mike knows far better than I do. But it's that ability to, number one, live kind of a double life. But I think you also at some level have to kind of count on the system, you know, to miss stuff. And when you understand the counterintelligence procedures, policies, practices of the organization that you're in, obviously it gives you an enormous advantage in terms of being able to beat the system. So, but in the case of the Cambridge Five, when we talk about motivations, I think they were like a lot of people back in the day, where there was this insane romanticism about the Soviet Union, about the Soviet model, and all the rest of that, and this idea that somehow the West was decadent, fallen, all the rest of that. And it's not as if, you know, plenty of stories about Soviet gulags were not coming out in this period of time, you know. So to me, it's impossible that Philby and the rest of those guys were not aware of those things, right? So I think it's also the ability to kind of deceive yourself, you know, about what it is you're doing and why you're doing it.
You know, from my experience, I think part of what happens in the intelligence community is there's a tendency to paint everything black or white. These are either good guys or bad guys, and not recognize that there's good and bad in every system and in every culture, and that the people who are expressing some animosity towards the West are not necessarily wrong in that criticism or somehow criminally dangerous because they have these ideas. And you know, particularly, I mean, I was sent my first undercover assignment into violent neo-Nazi group, right? Yeah, you know, when you're painting with the black and white, you know, they definitely fall on the bad guy side of things. But, you know, experiencing that where, you know, these were people who had very deeply held beliefs and you were trying to change society in a way that fit along with their beliefs. And the vast majority of them didn't engage in criminal activity and encouraged me to avoid the people I was hanging out with because they did. So, you know, I think gaining that perspective is really important, but it's easy to ignore when, part of kind of the human element of it was, as one of the instructors who, you know, in my career, I spent a lot of time doing training for other agents, the way he would explain undercover work to new trainees is he would say, look, your job is to befriend people, do what's necessary to gain their trust, and then betray them. don't paint any, you know, lovely pictures about what you're doing because it'll just confuse things. You know, that's your job. And, you know, when you can paint everybody as black or white, it's much easier to do that kind of betrayal. And, you know, when that flips to the other side and say somebody coming up in the system and, you know, I got a Penguin paperback that was published that had a foreword written by Le Carre that was really interesting because he talks about the Cambridge Five and sort of how he viewed it. And, you know, basically, and talks about the way Philby was close to James Angleton at the CIA, who once he realized he had been duped by Philby, went on a mission to find the moles within the CIA, and in many ways crippled the CIA for a number of years because of those internal investigations, where, again, it's looking for somebody who you have in your mind this picture of this very bad guy and not recognizing that that's not really the way it is. And, you know, it makes me think of scandal within the FBI, where the Chinese espionage unit found out that there was a leak of FBI information that was going to Chinese intelligence and did, you know, one of those insider threat and focused on a Chinese American agent and ruined her career, again, based on a polygraph, which, you know, even as criminal investigators, we know that it's not admissible because it's not accurate, right? It doesn't really have enough accuracy for us to say that this really works. When it turned out, it was a very prominent supervisor in the program who was considered the best. I mean, would have been like this Hayden character, you know, that had an illicit relationship with one of his sources, where the leak was apparently coming from. And it turned out that the number two person in the National Chinese Espionage Program was also having an illicit relationship with this same informant. So, you know, that kind of, you know, how do you even get your head around, number one, what what their motives were, and you know, was this just sex and didn't involve any kind of intentional espionage, you know, moving the information, and you know, they're alleged that she would simply pilfer his briefcase when he was napping after their interlude. You know, who knows? And how do you peel it back? Now, this person has been, you know, the number one person on Chinese espionage at the FBI for a decade or more. How do you then assess what's real and what isn't real? And this asset, you know, maybe wasn't, you know, was considered a prized asset, but now do we have to wonder whether any of that was true, and how do we unwind all of this? It's unfortunately real life, you know, and Le Corre does a really good job of expressing it in an artistic form, but what is that? Once you practice to deceive, it's just inherent in a system that is, by all measures, anti-democratic, right? I mean, just the very notion of the secrecy that this type of intelligence gathering demands is poisonous to a democratic society. You know, can only exist if there's public knowledge. We can only make decisions as a group, and particularly when they feel they have the authority to, as one FBI training slide said, bend or suspend the law in pursuit of their mission, you end up in a lot of problems. And I think that's certainly, you know, the response to 9/11 and the great expansion of this secret part of our government and the impunity in which they act, to where there wasn't any hesitation to having these very prominent heads of our intelligence agencies tell absolute falsehoods in public about the activities that they were engaged in, whether it was the warrantless wiretapping program or the torture program, to where how can the public express their will in how they want the government run when there's so much information being spread by the intelligence agencies that we're depending on to give us that true and verifiable information that we can make good policy choices from.
And what Mike has just described with respect to what happened, that was the Los Angeles field office, right, Mike? Is that, yeah. That episode with Chinese intelligence, you know, the American traitor was a white guy, right? And what did the Bureau do? They focused on the Chinese agent. And so we see this today, and this is something that Mike and I have spent a huge amount of time working on, is this whole China initiative that the FBI has had underway since 2018, right? And so the presumption is, ultimately, if you have a relationship with China, and especially if you are of Chinese heritage, we better take an extra look at you, and maybe a lot more than an extra look for you. And it's, of course, turned into a giant, you know, racial profiling disaster. A number of court cases now that they've either outright lost or had to drop because of the bogus nature of it. But that's not a new phenomenon. You know, I mean, this racial and ethnic aspect of it obviously was huge and continues, frankly, in the post 9/11 era, targeting Arab and Muslim Americans, right? Again, just on that basis, thinking that anybody is going to be an Al-Qaeda supporter if they come from that community, which, of course, is insane, completely nuts. But that's been a hallmark of American intelligence, you know, for the last 100 years, quite frankly. You know, when you look at how they handled German Americans and especially Japanese Americans, you know, during World War II. So that's an aspect of the business that's missing essentially from Le Carre's novels, at least the one that we're talking about, because these were all pretty much Caucasian folks. It's a very ideologically based frame, essentially, that Le Carre is using. And of course, that's directly connected to the time.
Thanks for listening. As always, the best way to get more Pop and Lock content is to follow us on Twitter. You can find us at the handle @PopandLockPod. That's Pop, the letter N, Lock with an E, like the philosopher, Pod. Make sure to follow us on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you listen, and please rate and review us if you like the show. We look forward to unraveling your favorite show or movie next time. Pop and Lock is a project of libertarianism.org, is produced by me, Landry Ayers, and is co-hosted by myself and our director and editor, Aaron Ross Powell. To learn more, visit us on the web at libertarianism.org.